If you're running a team yourself, if you're fortunate enough to have a security team, you want to have really, really smart people who are very technically savvy and who can go to the technology team to make sure those controls are embedded. But articulating the why of your information security journey is less about the technology and more about that sort of that organizational context.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to episode 2, season 2 of Upwards. Today, I have a fantastic guest with me, a man named David Higgins. David is a longtime security leader and has held roles at companies such as KiwiBank, Flybys, and I got that right, Jarden. David?
No, it was Jarden.
And, Jarden. And I'm really excited to have David. David is one of these rare people that can take quite hard to understand concepts that are quite technical and quite adept and explain them to everyday people, which is what he's been doing for the last several years in his role in various leadership roles. We're going to talk a little bit today about being a security leader, whether you're a reluctant security leader or a professional one, or one without, even without. So I'm really excited to be talking to him and diving in a little bit more into that. But first and foremost, this is Upwards, brought to you live on LinkedIn. You can also find us on YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts as well. We do this recording weekly. If you have any questions for David or myself as we go along, please leave a comment if you happen to be listening to this. And we would love to hear from you. We'd love to respond to that as best we can as well. And we like to interact kind of a little bit with the audience. So really excited to have him on board. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Phil. It's really good to be here. I appreciate you taking some time to invite me onto the show. Yeah, and also for such a flattering introduction, you know, I'll do
the guests look good.
Right. Well, you know, thank you, I appreciate it. I think there's so much cool stuff to talk about in this space, and I think for me, one of the things that I've really enjoyed over the last sort of, well, I mean, if I'm going to go back to the beginning of my career, you know, from the late 1990s through to today, you know, it's been a real interesting journey in watching this industry evolve, not only information security, but more specifically, you know, the evolution of technology as a business enabler and a strategic enabler for, you know, the modern world that we consume. So it's great to be here.
Very good. Well, let's get into it shortly. But for those of you who don't know me, my name is Phil. I'm the host of the Upwards podcast. I run a company called Omnidly, and Omnidly is a cybersecurity product which delivers you a security and privacy plan in a box. So we're helping, you know, organizations really, really increase their capability in terms of security and privacy planning and workflows. So if you're interested in that, please reach out. We'd love to talk to you. But let's get on with the show today. David, tell us a little bit about, you know, your background. You know, you mentioned you've been in this game for a little while. You still have that lovely youthful complexion. So, you know, whatever the secret you have, then keep doing it.
Maybe it's been a long time since anyone described me as youthful.
Scottish skin you have going on, whereas we're all, you know, we grew up in New Zealand, you know, sort of to a crisp by the time we're 10 years old. So we all look about.
Yeah, whereas in Scotland, you won't see the sun until you're 12. So, you know, it's kind of the opposite.
Tell us a little bit about your career, you know, where you've been, all sort of way up to perhaps what you're doing now. And we'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just going to adjust my ear so I can still hear you in a moment there, Phil. Yeah, so my career, I took the decision in 1997 to pursue experience over academia. So I didn't go to university or really do much in the way of sort of higher education studies, but I was always fascinated by computers. They were always a part of my life growing up. And so I decided that was kind of where I was going to focus my energy and efforts as a late teenager / early 20-something living in the south of England in the UK at the time. My first job was actually putting desktops on people's desks in a building society in the UK when they were transitioning from a paper-based workforce to a digitally enabled workforce. And so that was really where I built a lot of my initial experiences. And then I took that and sort of focused more on the systems administration and messaging collaboration types, you know, and that was through organizations such as Zurich Financial Services, Honda Motor Company in the UK, which had one of the best uniforms I've ever had to wear. and then on to things like Bayer Pharmaceuticals, where I sort of started evolving into a growing sort of security culture. Now, you know, Bayer was actually an excellent company to do that with, because as far as managing intellectual property and data protection, they were actually considerably ahead of, you know, a lot of other organizations of that time, because of course they were dealing with with intellectual property that was very, very important and underpinned a lot of their products that they delivered to markets around the world. So they had a very strong focus on data and information protection, and that crossed over with some of the work that I was doing in general sort of sysadmin work. So I started developing security specific knowledge at that point. And that was around about sort of 2007. 2009, my wife and I decided to come to New Zealand, and we were originally going to come for a 1 year holiday. That was a long time ago. And we've more or less been here ever since. But really coming here, it was really interesting because, you know, I got to see that information security industry re-evolve over here as it started to become a thing. And I possessed some skills in that space that I was able to bring to the organizations that I started working with. So that started off for me with Bank of New Zealand, you know, and then we went away for a year, came back, and then I was in Datacom. I helped them build out their security operations center. And then it was with Land Information New Zealand, where I was an advisor to a major cloud transformation project they were working on to replace Land Online, which is one of the most critical data sets in the entire country because it's the actual land ownership registry for the entire country. And there's only one of them and it's digital. So it was like, don't get this one wrong.
talking about confidentiality, integrity and availability.
Oh, integrity was of the utmost importance for that one because because the government is mandated to maintain confidence in the property register of the country. And if you can't do that because you don't have the right handle on the integrity of the data that underpins all of the ownership of land, then you have a major problem. But, you know, we had a lot of interesting developments in that space, which was really, it was a good time to be there. And of course they were looking at cloud deployments and doing a lot of interesting things there. Then I sort of took those skills and I took on security leadership roles, first at Flybys, which was Loyalty New Zealand. They were doing a significant cloud deployment. And then I went to Jarden, where they were doing something similar, disruptive cloud uplift, including new ways of working for their people, as well as the product offerings and things like that. And of course, that was during COVID as well. So the entire industry just kind of exploded at that point for a wee while there, which was really interesting and exciting. And then most recently, I was the CISO at Kiwi Bank, you know, helping shape up their overall security maturity, their security posture for a company, a bank that was, you know, that was going through a lot of change and disruption in the market, major rebranding and other things like that as well. And that sort of took me up to about December last year. And right now I'm actually taking a bit of a break. You know, I kind of got to the end of the year and I was like, you know, it's been a long time since I've actually slowed down. And, you know, and I have a young family, I have three children, you know, 9, 7, and 4. And for me, I felt like it was an opportune time to actually take a step back and, you know, take a breath, regather my thoughts, re-understand the things that really motivate me about this industry and just spend some quality time with my family. And, you know, and in my bio, I always say that most of my meaningful crisis management stuff comes from parenthood. And now being well practiced at the school runs, I can absolutely verify that.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, being sort of tortured on a, you know, on a daily basis as well, you know, kind of having building that resilience that we all have somehow from, you know, sleep deprivation and you know, people screaming at you and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
It's the unintended and the unexpected things. You know, you have a schedule, you have a plan, you know that the plan is there, but there's always something that causes the plan to deviate from where you want it to go. Now that is such a true thing in both information and cybersecurity and parenthood that, you know, I can't help but feel that the skills more or less complement one way or another.
I think there's a great conference talk there.
You know, managing, I can't tell you which one's more stressful though.
Managing stakeholders who sometimes, you know, are grumpy and they don't like you and you don't like them.
Grumpy toddlers. Well,
grumpy life artists.
I think that would have a limited shelf life in those circles.
Yeah, look, it is tough, right? And it's a human, like, I think, you know, one thing to tap into there is it's a human journey as much as, you know, we all talk about these technical controls and all these things we have to buy and do and protect our data. But ultimately, it's such a human exercise. And
it is.
You're dealing with humans, you're convincing humans, you're helping them deal with change, helping implement that change. And that is a tough job. And it's often the sort of so-called soft skills that are almost kind of the hardest. You know, it's one thing technically to to secure these things, to put it in software and all that sort of stuff. But then, you know, trying to convince a big stakeholder to give you money or to even just take notice of why this is important. Tell us a little bit about some of the human side of things that you've dealt with, and perhaps some aspects of that you find particularly interesting, and how to deal with those.
That's a fantastic question, Phil. Thank you for asking it.
Just throw that softball right there.
Softball, love it. Yeah. Well, you make a really good point, though, is that actually, you know, I think both you and I have mentioned that we have quite technical backgrounds. You know, I did a lot of sysadmin before sort of pivoting more towards information security leadership. And the things that I had to work on is, for me, you know, is that influencing and being able to take large complex ideas and break them down into ways that can be consumed by everybody. You know, and that's quite challenging. I haven't always been great at it. I've definitely had some challenges where, you know, I've been on the spot having to try and break down two different scenarios to a critical audience, and they see them in largely the same light because they kind of fall under the overall umbrella of information security stuff. But then sort of trying to articulate them as two different streams that are equally important and need to be, like, have different focuses applied to them. You know, those moments, those conversations are perhaps some of the most challenging, but some of the bits that are most important to have thought about in advance. You know, and particularly when it comes to things like information security incident response, because you have to have those conversations prepared for key stakeholders. You know, I'm thinking like executive teams and board members here, because those stakeholders do not have the same context that you do. This is not what they do. They recognize that it is a thing that they need to be able to practice. But actually that's another point that I want to make is that security is not a thing to be solved. It is not a challenge to be addressed. It is a practice to be expressed. It is something that we must do, and we must do continuously. You know, it's kind of like,
yes,
one day you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to play Claire de Lune in Madison Square Garden. You know, you're not just going to go out there and knock it out the park without having practiced for most of your life up to that point.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
With incident response, the trouble is you don't know when you're going to have to play Claire de Lune at Madison Square Garden. You just know it's going to happen at some point. So are you going to practice, or are you going to put it off thinking, well, it won't happen today?
Yeah, so, indeed. And I talk about this to some of our customers as well. And it's a multi-year journey. It's a marathon. It's not a one project, we're done, we're good, you know, move on to the next thing. It's a continual practice. And if you don't practice that, it atrophies, just like muscles, just like fitness. There's an analogy there. Even like development.
Okay, I feel attacked now. This is it. I've not been in the gym for a while. It's definitely happening.
Well, you know, it's a little bit like a development environment. You know, if you don't put anything into it, it atrophies, and it kind of eventually just stops working from the techies amongst it. So it's very much like that. And I think that's an important sort of thing to have in mind and convince people of. It's an organizational capability that we have to build and keep going on long term. Otherwise, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think for me, that's definitely one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about in sort of an information security leadership, because a lot of organizations in New Zealand and around the world, you know, they still have their information and cybersecurity embedded within their technology space, so it's viewed in the same context as your technology challenges. If I think about most of the key relationships that I've had to build out as a security leader, they've been with legal, corporate communications, they've been with risk, they've been, you know, very few of the relationships that I've had to build have been with the actual technology teams. You know, if you're running a team yourself, if you're fortunate enough to have a security team, you want to have really, really smart people who are very technically savvy and who can go to the technology teams and make sure that those controls are embedded. But articulating the why of your information security journey is less about the technology and more about that sort of that organizational context. The way that I've managed to sort of summarize this, you know, I had to have a think about the why of cybersecurity for me. And I've said, you know, and the way that I've described it is to say that you will always be a target for cybercrime, regardless of your organization, regardless of what you are doing. If you are a digitally enabled organization, you will always be a target. But the controls and the practice that you put in determine how much of a victim you will be of cybercrime.
Yeah, and I like that.
That's a piece that we have to be able to have that conversation at the highest levels of the organization. You know, yeah, prevention and preventative controls will always beat a wholehearted, concerted response effort. But you must understand that one day your controls will be insufficient for the threat that faces you. And when that happens, then you have to have practiced as well.
Indeed. And the response, the response makes all the difference, right?
It does.
And, practice, rehearse, things that you respond to me, protect, detect, respond is a really key part of that. And I think that's perhaps, so the part of the equation that not everyone always understands is that, we always think about protection and all these things up front and fancy pieces of software and hardware and all this sort of stuff to help with it. But how you respond, it's not just in security, it's anything to do when you're facing the customers and the public. Yeah. How you respond often makes it, much, much better or much, much worse in some cases. And sometimes people, response can either save you or it can actually kill you because the response is even worse than what actually happened in the first place. And so it really, really, really does matter.
It does. It does. And I think some of the most interesting insight I've ever had there, I've learned at other conferences where other people were talking about some of their incident response experiences. I might be borrowing the words from somebody else here, but they were a member of a military special forces unit. And they were saying, well, the important thing to remember about any kind of incident or incident response capability is you cannot train specialized personnel during a crisis. You have to have them ready, prepped, and understanding their role within the broader context of response prior to the crisis occurring. And it really is, it's so important to get that right. And you can find that it's quite easy to put that off because it becomes challenging within the organization. It's difficult to get time in people's diaries. It's difficult to organize an incident response piece, and you'll often find that people are like, well, we don't need to do that now. We've got other things that are a priority, and it'll be delayed for so long. But it's really important to get that there, because if you have to go to your executive leadership and say, guys, this is happening and we now have to go through it without having first practiced, it's a very difficult set of conversations to have.
Tell us a little bit about, budgets. We were sort of talking about this in the preamble a little bit before we started recording here. And then, it's always an interesting conversation.
Money.
Because money can sometimes organizations view this as a very zero-sum game. It's like you're taking money away from this pot and putting it into this pot. This pot means we can sell and grow and invest in marketing and sales and all this sort of stuff. You're taking money directly out of that and putting it into something like security, Now that's obviously a very chronic, crude way to think about it, but it's often, it often seems that kind of black and white. So how do you sort of navigate those conversations? And, how have you learned to be more convincing than people understand what the real trade-offs are?
Yeah, I think that, again, that's a great one. I love that we were sort of talking about money, because of course, like every other security professional, I will tell you that I have never had sufficient budget to be able to run the program that I wish to be able to run.
I think that's a real problem.
No, it is. And it's like, so, but you're absolutely right though, is that, the thing that we forget as security professionals is that actually security is one aspect of a focal point of a much larger organization. And, not to denigrate any organization's response and approach to this, but the view is not to be a security organization. It is to be an organization that delivers products and services and then is able to do that in an appropriately secure way for its context. Now, its context is often led by legal and regulatory frameworks. So, if you are working in the payment card industry, you'll have the payment card industry data security standard. If you're, if nothing else here in New Zealand, you'll have the Privacy Act. But those things are the Privacy Act is quite lightweight in what it determines appropriately secure to be. So you'll find that a lot of the conversations that you have to have, unless you are working with specific security frameworks, is around how are we being appropriately secure for the type of business that we are operating in. And that can be a tricky conversation to have, particularly when if you are in a growth phase for a business, they want to be able to maximize things like advertising, like exposure. They want to be able to make sure that they are in front of as many people and growing their customer base and product consumption. And you need to be able to not just talk about technology controls, but also the other things that you're doing, the practice of information security that goes along with that. And of course, as the company scales, at one point, you're going to have to turn around and say, well, look, guys, we've kind of hit that threshold where it's too much for one person. And now we need to be a security team because we have, you know, we don't just have the product, we have the underlying data and the capability, and we have the crown jewels of the organization. We have the feeding and the watering. We have the practice of security that we have to apply. And those can be really challenging conversations because a lot of organizations just expect technology to be done. You know, like, you know, we don't consider what a world-class patching cycle looks like, because it's technology. If it was working and it's available and it can serve my customers, then it's doing what I need it to do. So, you know, I think it is a tricky one. For me, the real benefit that I've had there has been in obtaining executive time, quite simply. You know, if I can get myself in front of a group of organizational leaders, and I am able to provide them with context and appropriate information, telling them why this is a priority and why they need to be focusing some budget there, not seeking to make it the next thing that they have to do, but actually making it an organizational priority, then that gives me, I find that that has given me the best results that I've had in that space of being able to build out security programs.
Yeah, and increasingly I'm seeing, you know, this doesn't apply to every single business, but security now becomes a competitive advantage. You know, because of the environment we're in, more and more prospective customers are doing their due diligence and they're assessing, they're addressing their own risks in this sense. And if you can present a stronger, more credible security story, that becomes a competitive advantage. And actually many people, the motivation, you know, it's one motivation. I think it's a good motivation, but because it helps get the job done, it helps make the case that we can spend some money here because it's going to give us a return in the form of increased confidence from prospective customers or partners or whoever you're dealing with. And that can result in real revenue, right? I'm dealing with some people at the moment where, you know, their competitor doesn't have a strong security story and they're looking, and this person I'm talking to is looking to sort of leapfrog them in that sense, and this will become a major competitive advantage for them. So, you know, I think that's a cool angle, right? And it's because sometimes it's not always, you know, we always talk about the scary things and the bad things can happen. Yes, that's part of it, but it's nice to be able to sort of, you know, support that argument.
I think it's a really good point, you know, like, because obviously, like, different organizations will have different focal points and different things that they wish to promote about their organization. And you're right, absolutely, having a good security posture is one of those things that you can sort of look to. You know, if I think about Kiwi Bank, you know, they put a lot of effort into making sure that they were a B Corp certified company, meaning that they were very environmentally conscious and environmentally aware. It was a really great thing to be able to do because it demonstrated, you know, where they explicitly cared about, you know, about sustainability and ensuring that those environment, you know, the environment was being well looked after within their organizational context. And that was a really important thing to them, you know, and trying to sort of capture that energy and that motivation and bring it into the information and cybersecurity space, because that, you know, it's really important to be able to find the things that the organization you're working with are passionate about and using it to kind of unlock that potential in their sort of security uplift space. Sometimes you'll go to a company and you'll find that they're phenomenal at it anyway, you know, and it's really nice to see that. I would say that I've probably been more involved in the disruptive uplifting kind of phases of companies, which is, I don't know, maybe I just picked the right time. I'm not sure. I always enjoy that kind of that passionate bit.
Definitely. And, you know, like B Corp organizations in part are driven by consumers, right? Driven by people that want to engage with companies that are led by values and that are led by these things. And I think more and more customers, and, you know, particularly sort of in the B2C space, they wake up and they go, actually, you know, this is going to make a real difference for me if they can really, you know, really demonstrate their security credentials and whatever way and shape and form that looks like, that will actually drive a lot of change as well. Definitely. Maybe we're not there yet, but I think there's huge potential.
I think we've got a few years.
Yeah, we've got a long way to go.
as we focus more on things like supply chain as well, you know, where I think if you're looking at, you know, organizations now have to have a really good handle on not just their third party risk, but their fourth party risk as well. What makes up the supply chain for the delivery of service and capabilities for the organization? Because ultimately, regardless of who you choose from like a partnership and collaboration perspective, if a security incident occurs that impacts your customers, you are always accountable to your customer for that. And we've seen, you know, and unfortunately in a lot of data breach events that have occurred, you know, we've seen those things where it wasn't the company itself that was at error or was compromised. It was part of the supply chain that led to an attacker being able to get a foothold and ultimately taking that information and data away. The customer doesn't really care about the supply chain at that point. They're like, well, I engaged you.
They have a relationship with you. Exactly.
Yes. You know, and I think that, but where we see that supply chain becoming a more prominent feature of due diligence, of people, of companies' engagement across the spectrum there, you know, being able to say, yes, we are really good at this, and being able to back that up with, you know, with appropriate certifications, with third-party due diligence, with these things that allow you to assert maturity in your information security posture, really do start to differentiate you from your competitors.
Yeah, and look, touching on that third-party, the supply chain issue, you know, sometimes I've heard some people sort of casually say, well, look, it's their problem if, you know, they get breached or whatever. But no, it's your problem. Like if someone else breached, it's 100% your problem. You can't sort of absolve yourself or say, well, look, I've pushed it all down. There's 100% your problem. And that's, you know, we're like you say,
you're never not accountable.
Incident response. You're going to be practicing incident response, whether it's you that has the breach or anyone in your supply chain has the breach. It's 100% on you. And I've been in businesses where I've seen this firsthand, where, you know, they've relied on a lot of third party services, and inevitably something happens downstream, and guess who gets it? You know, guess who the customers come to, the response makes all the difference, right? You can get that right, or you can make it a lot worse. So.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. I think, and you know, you're absolutely right. It is so important to have thought about this prior to the event occurring, but recognizing as well that the event will occur. You know, it's a number of times that I've heard people, you know, saying at various sort of security conferences, the Mike Tyson quote, you know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. It's like, I like that quote, but I don't, it's almost not severe enough, because like, to me, it brings to mind boxing, and boxing is a very well-regulated sport. Whereas you're going up against one person, they're roughly the same weight as you. You have 3-minute rounds and you can tap out if you're taking
a highly controlled.
You get to do that in incident response. You know, it's more like a street fight, because there might be 5 of them. Somebody might have a knife and nobody's going to tap it out if you're getting a kicking. You have to go through it to get to the other side. And I think, you know, that this is something that, you know, this might be a slightly severe way to look at it, but actually, you know, you have to build that understanding that it is going to happen over a long enough time frame. Over a long enough time frame, the likelihood of the incident occurring rises to 100%. What are you doing when it does? And having those conversations with your leadership, with your stakeholders, is you know, it can be tricky, particularly because you're approaching an uncomfortable subject, you know, and it's like, but it also allows you to have meaningful conversations with other parts of the organization as well. Because you have to go to your corporate comms team or whoever is responsible for fronting customer communications and say, well, how will we communicate this to our customers if we have to tell X percentage that we've lost their information? And then you have your legal teams where you're like, well, how are we going to ensure that we're doing what we can to protect our customers? How have we engaged with our cybersecurity insurance? And would we even be covered? Have we done enough in the technology control space to be able to assert that we are appropriately covered if we have to look at this? You know, there are so many variables.
I like that. I really like that kind of empowering question approach that you're sort of doing there, where you're sort of saying to them, well, you know, how do we deal with this? You know, empowering them to say, oh, well, I haven't really thought about that, or maybe we can do it this way. So you get their involvement by it, as opposed to kind of going and telling them, which is always a terrible way to do things. But you're inviting other people to participate with you in formulating how things are going to happen, but you're framing it in a way that this is kind of inevitable. So we're going to spend some time preparing for it.
And I think, yeah, that is, and really for me, you know, definitely some of those key outcomes that I've had have been engaging with other parts of the organization, and any organization that I've been in, and saying, you know, we know that this is going to happen. And when it does, it's more than I will be able to deal with. You know, this is like, you can't just go, well, our security team's going to handle that. And I'm like, well, I'm not a corporate comms. I'm not a communication spokesperson. I will not be in front of TV New Zealand talking about these things because, you know, if I'm doing my job correctly, mm-hmm. I'm going to be making sure that our environment is appropriately secured so that we have high confidence going forward that we're not going to repeat the same mistake. You know, I won't be having the conversation with customers X, Y, and Z. You know, we'll have if there's a call center that we have that engages with our customers, if we have our corporate comms team, how are we going to have those messages delivered? How are we going to provide assurance and context? And that's mm-hmm. really important as well. You know, I think one of the things that I wanted to sort of touch upon, and I tend to ramble and go back to my original point quite a lot, is that most of the organizations that I've worked with, what they really want when they engage sort of a security leader, is they want assurance. They want assurance that either they're doing things correctly or that we can get things done correctly to be able to go forward. And those assurance layers come internally from, you know, from your internal security and technology teams that are responsible for delivering and maintaining the controls, the technology controls, but then also your external assurances, your point in time assessments of your security posture through things like ISO 27001, PCI DSS, yes. and other regulatory frameworks. But then your ongoing piece as well, where you are asserting the organizational maturity. And the two things that I've found to be incredibly helpful there are asserting that, one, if I can't see it, I cannot protect it. And two, if I cannot measure it, I cannot improve it. And so those are kind of like, for me, those are kind of foundational pieces that you should approach the organization with. You're saying, first, I need to understand. I need to be able to see everything. I don't necessarily need to be able to change it immediately, but I must be able to see it and I must be able to measure it if I am to protect it and then improve that protection as well.
Yeah. So your job as a security leader is to help make things visible and help make things measurable.
And then make sure that we're ready for the day when it all kind of falls apart, because it will eventually. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Well, look, I hope people take some value out of this conversation. I think this is fascinating stuff. You know, I think this is often, you know, the parts that it's a little bit harder to find, you know, on the internet when we're trying to, you know, desperately look for templates and technologies and things like that. So I really appreciate you spending time with us.
No, it's my pleasure. I think, you know, it's a really interesting point, Phil, because we're still not talking about this in a meaningful way, I think, you know, because organizations, they don't like to talk about those things where they feel like they have failed or they have, you know, whether they have encountered failure in this space. But I think that it's something we need to be able to talk about this, because it's not uncommon. This happens to organizations all around the world every day. And some of the best experience you'll ever get, or some of the most learning you will ever achieve, is through the experience of not being successful. You know, one of the things that I've really focused on with the teams that I try and build is creating an environment where we encourage experimentation and failure as part of growth towards better overall protection. And you can see that that's sort of embodied in things like DevOps, DevSecOps, but also just the more sort of the broader kind of, we move fast, we fail forward, we're okay taking risks because we have the underlying assurance in place that we can do that in a safe and scalable way. You know, but failure is a part of that journey.
Yeah, and exactly, and creating a safe space to fix the system, as it were, as opposed to punish the individual. You know, at Pushpay, we talked a lot about
security lacks safe spaces at the moment.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
you know, because it's one of those areas where people are like, well, we can't fail here because if we do, we failed everywhere. And it's like, well, yeah, but you don't get
what part of the business has this infallible kind of expectation around it. You know, I think, you know, we go back to the just culture thing. It's like, you ask the question, how did we fail as a system, as a company to do this? Not one individual, you know, in the engineering space. Yeah. It might be an individual developer who ships something which breaks production that goes down for a couple of hours. But so, you know, you could punish the individual and, you know, and fire them, you know, at the most extreme or whatever. But is that really going to fix the system which led to that happening? You know, why did that happen? Was that person code being reviewed? Were they tired? Were they being overworked? You know, what was the expectations on their shoulders? And how did the system lead to that individual person finally failing? Because it wasn't really just a single failure. It was a failure of design. And security can be the same. You could blame it on the CISO, you can blame it on this individual person, but really, what happened? Why did a system fail? And just culture is saying, how do we change the system so that those outcomes are far less likely to happen? And we take the collective learning and we don't punish the individual, because ultimately it's not really the individual's fault.
No, that's the company, right?
Yeah, that's
so important. You know, I think for me, you know, definitely when I look at some of the incidents that I've responded to over my career, you know, we haven't even gotten to the war stories bit yet. So, you know, but one of the things that I found is like a really key learning there is, you know, if you are in an incident response thing, you're absolutely running a timer. And what the standard organizational response is to get everybody across and to do that for as long as is required to get yourself back to where you need to be. But the thing that we tend to overlook there is actually, if we're relying upon the same group of people to respond and then continue to run the organization post-response, that's an incredibly difficult thing that we are doing, you know, and that's that organizational fatigue really does sort of set in at that point. And it's something that I've found to be, it is something that is quite a challenge that we are sort of facing into, because we don't build security capabilities that effectively run on a two-team basis for incident response capabilities. You know, we have one security team. We don't build an A team and a B team, so that if the A team has had to respond to a massive incident, the B team can step in and oversee the organization whilst group A recovers. We don't do that because we've probably not looked at it at that level yet. You know, if you look at, and unfortunately, I would say the only other industries where you see capabilities like this existing are sort of in your first response and your emergency services and also like your military type spaces as well, where they go, okay, well, we need to have a group of people on standby, because if this group here is going to go and do something, they cannot then go back to standby because they are spent. And I think that's something that we need to get better at in this space as well. And it does absolutely shape into that culture as well, because it's like, they're not just doing nothing. Like nobody just does nothing, but we need to have a group of people who can effectively come in and provide that backup and support to the organization post event. And I think that's, you know, we often overlook that. And I have had to have a number of conversations with exec teams and sort of going, look, we are extremely fatigued. We need to be able to stand people down, and we need to be able to do that in a way that is healthy and ensures that we don't burn out people, because burning out people is the worst thing that you can do in an industry like security.
Indeed, you need to look after your people, and especially where good people, you know, should be looked after first and foremost, but are also really, really critical to the team and a valuable asset to the organization, and have that experience, which is even more valuable as well, which is even better reason to make sure that we preserve that experience. That's all we have time for today, but I want to bring you back for some more war stories in the future. So we'll save those for a future. So look, thank you, David. I really appreciate spending the time with us, sharing these great insights that, you know, obviously are quite hard won for all of us. And it's always great that we can kind of get to pick up on those and learn from those. Thank you. And look, audience out there, if you have any questions for David or for myself, please just leave a comment. We will get back to you. We'd love to hear from you. You know, so ask us anything and we'll do our best to answer from you. That is it for this week. You'll be able to find this episode obviously on LinkedIn, but you'll see it, you know, on YouTube and your podcasts as well. So please like, subscribe, comment, all that sort of usual stuff. And we will see you next time. Thanks again.
This is Upwards, the podcast for security and tech leaders, brought to you by Omidly. Don't forget to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts, and join us again next time for more on security, startups, and leadership.